You're listening to episode 6 of season 13 of the New World Order for 32-2019. In this episode, we've got some listener feedback about calendaring systems. We've got feedback about ZFS. We got a coffee break with a special coffee that I don't believe I've discussed on this series yet, so this will be exciting for me. And finally, the Grav Flat CMS blogging platform. Big old review with lots of technical detail. So let's get started. First and foremost, let's look at some listener feedback. I got a really, really long email here from Deep Geek, and I feel like I'm missing one from him. But if I dig that up, then I'll include that next time. But this one's a good one. This one's plenty to cover in one episode. So first of all, he says, show dating. Congratulations on reinventing Julian dating for New World Order. Haven't used this since my old COBOL programming days. That is fascinating. But when Talk Geek to Me was a tech show, DeepGeek used to have a show called Talk Geek to Me, which turned in, it started out as a technical show, actually, and then it kind of became this sort of independent journalism show about news from abroad. So anyway, he numbered his shows then in hexadecimal, which was quite, which I do remember admiring a lot. And then he gives me a date command, date plus percent capital Y dot percent lowercase j. I feel like I mentioned that on the show, so he might have missed me mentioning it, or maybe he's a show behind or something. But I'm pretty sure I mentioned the date and then the plus sign and then percent. The way that I do it is I do percent lowercase j dot percent uppercase y, and that gives me 032, for instance, for the February 2nd, what we used to call February 2nd back in the dark ages, 032.2019. So I knew that my system, well, I assumed my system was not unique. I mean, I'm just counting the days within a rotation around the sun, so it doesn't seem like I would have been the first person to think of that. I did not know that it was called a Julian calendar or a Julian date. So I looked up Julian dates, and I don't see that this is the same system. I want to know the system that I am using. I would be curious about that, but I don't see that the Julian date translates, and I'm not saying Deep Geek is incorrect, I'm just not seeing it. So according to the aa.usno.navy.mil/data/docs/juliandate.php, which was just the first thing that came up in DuckDuckGo when I did a search, it said that Julian dates, abbreviated JD, are simply a continuous count of days and fractions since noon, universal time on Jan 1, 4713 BC on the Julian calendar, meaning almost 2.5 million days have transpired since that date, at the time of this writing, obviously. Julian dates are widely used as time variables within astronomical software. Typically, a 64-bit floating point, that's double precision variable, can represent an epoch expressed as a Julian date to about 1 millisecond precision. Note that the time scale that is the basis for Julian dates is universal time, and that 0 hours UT, that's universal time, corresponds to a Julian date fraction of 0.5. So I don't see how the Julian calendar translates, because I don't see anything. In fact, on this same site, there is a compute calendar date, or compute Julian date, rather. And so if I put in 2019 February 03 AD at 0 hour, well, let's do 0 hours and 1 minute, compute Julian date, it gives me back a value of 2458517.500694. So that doesn't sound like, because I'm not doing the Julian date nonstop. I'm going to reset my calendar next year. So in other words, in 2020, the first show of New World Order will be, 02-2020 or 03 or whatever date it is. I haven't looked, but that's my take on the idea. Although maybe DB is saying that if I take my I take that year, the 2019 or the 2020 or whatever year it is, and then do the maths on that, then I'll get a Julian date, which that sounds fair to me, but it's not. Yeah, I'm not intentionally doing the Julian calendar. I'm just doing whatever it's called when you count within the solar, the rotation around the orbit around the solar body that we call the sun. Okay, so that's that topic covered, I think. Next up, he says, ZFS, you're well on your way, but I was wondering, did you create the Zed pool and write your art files directly to that, or did you create a data set also? In ZFS, the Z pool command deals with making physical devices into a virtual device, but then management of that virtual device is broken into data sets, which can be created, have properties changed and customized, be snapshotted and destroyed with the command ZFS. Thus, it is possible to have a home directory on one data set on the computer and have a /share/local be another data set, which is just a random example off the top of his head. That all went over, it's off the top of his head. Well, it went over my head. So I need to do more reading on ZFS before I understand my options there. And yeah, the previous episode or so when I created the ZFS thumb drive, which is still sitting right here, it was me sitting down reading up on how to do it just from the man page, and I think from an example online, if I recall correctly, and that's it. That's as much as I, that's as far as I got with that experiment. As for now, I mean, I'm gonna continue to look into it for sure. And then he says, co-op web hosting sounds exciting. I really want to know what their software stack is. Is it cPanel and Apache, or is it one or several of the open source server control softwares? I would love to say that it was one of the several open source control panel softwares, but it is cPanel. It is based around cPanel. I think I've used cPanel once or twice before on varying accounts. I try to avoid it if I can, and I don't say that with malice necessarily. I've never had like what I would call a horrible experience with cPanel. It's just, it's like learning any GUI, right? Like you can either learn where they hide options and where what their logic is like, or you can just learn the server stuff and do it directly on the server. And that flexibility is one of the things that I quite like about webhosting.coop, is I'm not bound to doing all the things in the GUI. And then GeekGeek also has some further thoughts on just the idea of customer service. And this is kind of an interesting long paragraph, but I'm going to read it anyway just because I don't think I can summarize it and capture everything. And he's a pretty interesting guy. So your analysis of customer service is spot on, and I've been thinking of along similar lines. But I now believe also that the common situation with web hosts is systemic to the capacity of modern server hardware. Since a modern, younger than 3 years old, max, handles, I think he's probably saying server, since a modern server, handles thousands of connections and dozens of thousands of accounts. Yes, Virginia, most web hosts are resellers out there. One server box, when loaded to capacity, results in more clients served than a small business can imagine. Imagine also that a company like Amazon Web Services, AWS, will need to configure dozens of thousands of servers when they open another 8-megawatt data center. And you can see that trying to configure a web server with a unique name and unique configuration is impossible. It is very obvious that servers themselves are being configured using software tools that roll out hundreds or thousands of identically configured web servers at a time. See faiproject.org or fai-project.org. Case in point, recently a partner of mine and a server and a consultant who has a little web hosting for his clientele, when needed, both complained about the service at this one upstream we both used. My belief is that it doesn't matter. If your upstream is successful, they must subcontract customer service out to another company. And if they stay mom and pop, and it's going to remain a matter of no customer service on Christmas and New Year's. On the hardware level, a vanilla lamp stack with cPanel is a vanilla lamp stack with cPanel. So I think those are a lot of thoughts and a lot of different thoughts. I think that this idea of the fully automatic installation, which is what the FAI-project.org sort of bases itself around. I mean, it is modern system administration, really. FAI project, or FAI, I don't know how you're supposed to say it, fully automatic installation, offers an ISO which you can boot into and then have a bunch of, like DeepGeek says, a bunch of identical servers created essentially from one point of origin. Similar ideas are all over the place, like Ansible nowadays. Ansible's very purpose in life is to look at, well, I mean, you can do a Kickstart file and install CentOS or Fedora or whatever, Red Hat, and then run Ansible, and they get all configured the same way, and Ansible can maintain them. I mean, it's just like these pools and pools of servers. And then you get into questions of things like, quote unquote, and these are big air quotes here, serverless config or serverless cloud, or what do they say? Like, I don't know, the word serverless, which of course is nonsense, right? It's a buzzword. But this idea that you as that any application developer or maintainer of any presence on the web really should never or shouldn't really think of a server. You know, like the idea of a server itself is sort of fading, and I know a lot of people don't like that. And to a degree, I don't like it. But in another way, it is good, because I think the idea is that there's this big cluster. You know, the network is the computer coming to fruition. There's this cluster of computing power, and your thing, whether it's a website or a web app or a sort of a network-aware application, you know, whatever it is, it exists out there in this cloud. Like, that's like the very idea of, well, you don't have to really pin it down. You can just say, well, it exists out there, whether it's a bunch of VMs that run, and then when one falls over, the other one picks up where that left off, so that there's no interruption in service, or whether it's a container inside of some kind of host OS, whether that host OS itself is a VM or an actual server, but redundant, of course. You know, you've got all all this redundancy and all of these things that kind of, from at least many people's perspectives, make the idea of, like, okay, well, which server is it? Where does my data, you know, which physical metal box has my data on it? Well, it really doesn't matter, because your data is just being jockeyed from here to there as bandwidth and storage demands necessitate. Are you relying on that infrastructure staying operational and alive and secure, and do you feel comfortable relying on that? That's a different question. That's a question, you know, I mean, your own backups obviously need to be redundant. So if you don't trust this big entity of network computational power, then yeah, you should have local backups. But in terms of this model, it's kind of here. It is upon us. And that's the very reason that you see for things like systemd and all these other kind of new models of dealing with really how data is handled, but also how all of it is, what it all sits on. Like I say, I'm not necessarily saying that this is good, not necessarily saying it's bad. I am simply saying that it is a reality of modern IT. And it would be disingenuous, I think, to ignore it, because if you're going to go get a job in IT, that's the kind of maintenance that you're at least, like, if we were rolling a die, it would be at least a 50% chance that when you go into IT, you're going to you're going to be dumped into a big data center that says, hey, we need you to spin up 1,000 quote-unquote servers, and they need to be all configured exactly the same. No DNS collisions, no namespace collisions, you know, all of these things, like these things have to happen. We want them, if one falls over, we want another one to pick up right away. And that's part of IT now. That is a part of entry-level IT. Whereas I feel like a long time ago, entry-level IT was sort of like, can you set up a server? Can you configure a mail server? Can you get a website going? That sort of thing. It's a lot bigger, and there's more of it. It's a bigger room that you're sitting in, and there's a lot more things that we point at and say, that's the server running this software, or that's the cluster running, you know, managing this software and all of the failover and failsafe and redundancy and stuff like that. Okay, so that's what I took away from Deep Geek's feedback. Thanks for the feedback, Deep Geek. It's very interesting. Always interesting to hear thoughts about this sort of thing. Time for a coffee break. Let's go get coffee. You go get a cup for yourself. I'm going to go get a second cup for myself. We'll meet back here for the rest of the show. You've got your coffee. I said I was drinking sort of a special coffee, and I am. It's not really the brand that is special or the roast or whatever. Well, it is the roast. So this is, I think it's actually Papagayo, I think, something like that. It's a Papagayo, or I'm probably saying the word wrong. I can see it in my head, and I'm just not saying it correctly. But it's parrot. In a couple of different languages, from what I can tell. And certainly there's a parrot on the coffee bag anyway, but there's also an animation software called Papagayo, and it is, it's pretty good. It's a lip-syncing software, actually. It's not directly, like, you don't animate with it, but you look at your animations, and you take your script. No, you don't look at your animation, sorry. You take your script, you type it in, and then you throw it through, you process it through Papagayo, and then it tells you what the mouth position of your animated figure should be. So it analyzes the phonemes of your script and figures out, okay, at this point in time, their mouth should be, you know, sort of open and sort of like an O sound, an O shape. And then this here, it should be closed and tight-lipped, but and here it should be puckered like an S or whatever. So that's Papagayo. Anyway, it's got nothing to do with coffee. But it does have something to do with parrots. So this has a parrot on it. But the reason all of this is significant is because I got a briki for over the winter holidays from my partner. And along with the briki, I got this bag of coffee. And now if you've never... So this is what they call either... It depends on who you're talking to, I guess. But people call this Greek coffee. I knew someone from Eastern Europe who called it Turkish coffee or Russian coffee. So it really just kind of depends on who you're talking to. But it is if you've never seen it, it is a, you know, the bag of coffee, right? You open it up and it'll surprise you if you've never seen it because it's powder. It's ground to a powder, like a fine powder. I'm not talking really even about, like, you might think, oh, it just sounds like an espresso grind or something. No, this is, it is, if you didn't know it was coffee, you might mistake it for cocoa powder, almost. I mean, it's almost that. It's not quite that fine, but it is almost that fine. And a briki is a small little coffee pot. So it's a little saucepan, and it's about, I don't know, about eight ounces, maybe 10 ounces. You put a teaspoon of this powder thin coffee into the briki. You put your water into it, and then you put it on the stove. I have to take the oven in this apartment has these big sort of metal grates over the heating element, and the coffee pot is so small that it will not fit on the grating because there's, you know, ovens have, like, or stoves have breaks in the grating sometimes. So I actually have to take the grating off, and I just put the coffee pot straight onto the heating element, turn it on fairly low. It's a gas oven or a gas stove. And so I turn that on fairly low because otherwise the flame, again, just actually goes too far out, you know, and so I kind of put it on somewhat low so that it's actually hitting the briquet directly, and wait about, I don't know, 5-7 minutes until it just starts to boil, and you'll know because there the top of your coffee starts to froth a little bit. It actually forms like a foam, and you take it off of the burner, pour it into your mug, and that's it. You drink it. And so notice now that there's no... Now, the first time I had it, well, I should say, so notice there's no coffee filter. You simply put the coffee into the briquet, you put the water in, you boil it, you pour it, and then you start drinking it. Now, when you are finished the cup of coffee, there is a sludge at the bottom of coffee grounds. You don't really want, or coffee powder. You don't want to drink that. It's not good. It tastes horrible. But the coffee itself is amazing and quite unique tasting. I would probably say that if you're going for if you're a typical coffee drinker and you know coffee that you get at stores and cafes and stuff, this would probably be an acquired flavor because it's not going to taste really what you're used to. It's quite unique. Now, the first time I had it, it was very sugary as well. And I don't know, I'd be interested in hearing if I have any Greek or Turkish or Russian listeners, whether it is considered like more traditional to have it very sweet or what. I've just taken to having it just, you know, black and just straight. But the first time I had it, it did have a bunch of sugar in it. So it was like a very sort of sweet coffee, but I can't drink sweet things like all day, whereas I can drink coffee all day. So that's what I'm having right now. And that's what I've been having for the past couple of weeks since the end of the past, into the past year. It's been quite nice. It's been a real pleasure to finally be able to make this the proper way. I've been making it before in just a normal saucepan, and it just doesn't have quite the same effect. Making it in a briquet is sort of the way to go. So and they're not super expensive or anything. I mean, you can get a briquet at your local Greek supply store, you know, like if you've got a Greek market or something, they're probably there. You can get them cheap. It's the size and form factor really that you're looking for. So if you've never tried that, you should try it because it is very good. And another thing you should try if you've never tried and you're looking for a flat file CMS system is a little project called Grav. You can find more out about Grav at getgrav, getgrav. .org, and it's a fantastic little software that I've been using recently quite a lot. So the first time I tried Grav must have been 4 years ago when I was thinking about setting up a little personal sort of tech blog. And I think I might have even been evaluating it for use with GNU World Order. I don't exactly remember, but that was around that time that I was sort of transitioning everything from GNU World Order from just sort of manually entered stuff to completely automated posting. And the advantage of GitGrav is that it is a flat file CMS. So a CMS, if you don't know, is a content management system. It's a fancy word for a framework for your blog or for a website in general, really. But traditionally, the idea is that it's a blog. It's getting posts on some kind of regular basis. It doesn't have to be a daily by any means, but it's, you know, sometimes. So the famous one would be, of course, WordPress. WordPress is a very famous CMS, and honestly, I kind of feel like that's the one. I could be totally wrong about this. I kind of feel like that's the one where the concept CMS really got sort of formalized. That yes, there are these things now, and they manage your blog, and what are we going to call them? Oh, I know, content management services, CMS. So Joomla would be another one. I guess Drupal would probably qualify, although I think of Drupal as being big, you know, bigger than a CMS, but I guess that's probably being silly. So yeah, there are these CMSs out there, and as you can probably tell by the ones that I've listed, they involve a database. So you create a database on a server somewhere, and then you create a user in that database, and then you install this thing on top of or on the same server. Well, not doesn't even have to be at the same server, on a server, and you configure that CMS, like WordPress, to log into that database and to put data there. So when you do a blog post and you click post or save draft or whatever, WordPress is taking everything that you've entered, throwing it into this database over wherever that database lives. Sometimes it's on the same server, sometimes it's on a separate server. It just kind of depends on how your setup has been configured. Maybe you've configured it yourself, maybe your web host is doing it for you, who knows? And that's fine. I mean, that works fine, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's a thing that you can do, right? So I didn't want to do that, though. It's not that I have a problem with that model. It's just that I knew for myself that I didn't want to have to mess around with the database stuff. I didn't want to have to keep on top of all this PHP and MySQL or MariaDB security fixes and updates and things like that. It's just that was not something that I wanted to get into. And then I also thought, well, you know what, with WordPress too, my partner in real life, she does a lot with WordPress. She does a lot of theming on WordPress, and you, in order to theme it, you have to do these child themes, and or to theme it correctly, you do these child themes, and you can override CSS stuff and all this other. I thought, you know what, I don't want to learn that stuff. I've made a child theme for a WordPress site before. I'm familiar with the process. It's just not something that I'm interested in learning. I didn't want to learn like the file structure, the file system layout of WordPress. That's just not, it's not that I hate it. It's not that I don't want to. It's not that I have a problem with the idea. It's just, it didn't excite me. That was not something that I wanted to do. So I thought I would be more comfortable with a flat file CMS, because a flat file CMS is, I guess, a little bit more, almost in a weird way, it's kind of the old school of the internet. You go to a server, you look at a page, you are seeing that page. In other words, you are opening a file on a server, and that is how you are seeing that page. Now it's being rendered and made pretty by your web browser, by the intervention of by the use of HTML and the intervention of CSS, but the file, there's a one-to-one match there, and that appeals to me a lot. And of course, on WordPress or Joomla or Drupal or whatever, you go to a quote web page, and you're just seeing a node in a database being inserted into a structure that is being assembled by a bunch of different pieces and displayed in your web browser. That's less appealing to me. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna go flat file. And I remembered that I had been using Grav, that I tried Grav about 4 years ago. Now, all of this, the whole thing about Grav came about because I had used something even earlier. I think it was called FlatPress. And I think FlatPress technically is still around. I think you can still kind of find it, but I have a really hard time understanding what exactly is going on. I mean, they've had a blog post as of the 12th day of 2019, and it said that there's not a whole lot happening with it. Big things will be happening in February, apparently. That's according to their post, and that's cool and it's great. I still don't quite get I don't have a good feel for where they are exactly in their lifespan. I don't know what they have in mind. And so on. So I thought to myself, well, I want to build something that's going to have some degree of mass appeal. Grav is pretty. Grav is a flat file CMS. Grav sounds like it's the one for me. So I installed Grav onto a server and started messing around with it. And what do you know? It really is quite nice. It's also nothing like all of my assumptions of what I was going to be benefiting from by using a flat file CMS. Does not apply to Grav. So all of my critique of WordPress and Joomla and Drupal almost all of those critiques apply to Grav equally. Okay, so let's talk about Grav. Grav, it's a super easy install. Like, really, honestly, you take Grav, you download it from getgrav.org, you place it on your server in a publicly viewable place, you've just installed Grav. Like, that's it. There's no 5-minute setup, like in WordPress. There's no fiddling around with a database. It's installed. You're done. That's it. And that is because it's a flat file CMS, right? Everything's self-contained within Grav. So when you place this file, this folder on your site, then Grav knows to refer sort of within itself for all of its data. And so it's all, you know, there's a bunch of PHP files and some weird looking twig files is what they're called. They're sort of template files. And there's markdown files. And what Grav does, the markdown file is your blog post. And what Grav does is it looks for a specific item in a specific place, which is the user/pages directory of your little Grav install. And you put a markdown file in there called, I think, blog.md, and then you've just created a blog. There are some YAML headers at the top of the file that you need to put in. But if you put a blog.md there, then you've just created a blog with auto-generating RSS and Atom feeds. And all you do is you literally open up a markdown file and you type words into it, and then Grav looks for that file. If that file exists, then it uses it. It parses the headers, it parses the markdown, converts it to HTML, and it displays it. It caches it. And when people go to your site, example.com/Grav blog or slash blog or whatever you called the directory containing Grav, then it displays that page to the user. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. It's also really, really nice. Now, I'm going to get to all the caveats, but I'm going to say, first of all, that it's really, really nice that this is completely, it's just a file on a file system, right? So any way you can imagine to get a file onto that file system is completely fair game. So you want to do this via SSH? Done. No problem. So if you want to be able to just type in a thought and then post it, you can do that. You make an alias, for instance, that opens up Emacs, and then when Emacs closes, it does an automated SCP of the file that you just closed and copies it to your Grav folder as a blog post or as a page on your site. There's the structure of the files there's a little bit of flexibility there, but the default setup, from what I can tell, is that in your user pages, if you have a numbered directory, so a 01.blog, 02.photos, 03.randomthoughts, then those become tabs, if you will, on your web page. A file called blog.md inside of any of those folders creates a little self-contained blog site inside of that folder. Or if you just want to put random stuff in there, so when I say blog, it means that there's now you have a master page that lists all of the blog posts. And the blog posts themselves take form as, again, a directory with some name, and then a file inside of them called item.md. So you've got a blog.md in the outside folder, and then you've got another folder in there representing each post with an item.md inside. As long as you keep that structure, everything gets parsed correctly, and you have a navigable site. Now, if you're not doing a blog, maybe you just want to do the 01.blog, 02.photos, 03.randomthoughts. Those are tabs now on your site, and you can structure it so that they go, that a user could maybe click into one of those tabs, and then has a choice of pages to go to from there. It kind of depends. You know, you can use it as a documentation site, you can use it as a blog, you can use it as a site for any kind of content that you want. And there are plugins for Grav to help you reach quickly the kind of basic structure that you're looking for. For instance, for the site that I was building with Grav, I wanted there to be a blog. And when you go to that blog, I wanted you to see the articles listed in an attractive manner. I didn't exactly care how, but I figured sort of like big buttons or whatever, like what do you call them? Like when you see a little summary of the article and maybe a little header image, that kind of thing, you know? And you look at it and you read the title and you read the snippet and that sounds like an interesting article. So you click on it and then it takes you to the full page. So I wanted that. I wanted an array of sort of cards, as it were, little index cards with each article kind of featured on each card. And the blog plugin does exactly that. So easy, job done. And there are similar, you know, there are different setups for different models. So maybe you want a photo site. So you really want just a big web gallery. Well, there's a plugin for that. So there are lots of different ways to kind of manage Grav, and it really does depend on what plugin you install and how you structure the files on the file system. Okay, so the positive thing is simply that it's all flat files, it is plain text, it is automatable. You can shoot files up to your server in any manner that suits you. If you're more of a visual type person and you want to open up a graphical SFTP client and copy your files manually, you know, you can do that. If you want to set up some kind of Git Echo service, you can do that. It's a file on a file system, so it is super, super easy to design your own custom workflow. And that's exciting. That's exactly what I wanted. Grav also happens to be really, really attractive. Like if you go to their site, getgrav.org, you see that it looks really nice, and they have a couple of sample sites as well. I think down at the bottom of the page where they say, you know, these places are using Grav, and you can look at the places that are using Grav, and you can kind of see how they're using it for a different angle on Grav, you know, depending on what the site is about. So it doesn't look, you know, FlatPress, for instance, while I really like it because it is super flat, it looks a bit dated. You know, if you look at it, there would be a lot of theming that you would probably want to do. Sure, there are themes that others have done, but in terms of getting something maybe that looks really slick and really modern, it might take a little bit longer for you to get there from flat. Press. Grav kind of has a lot of that built in. It is very much a modern kind of, it looks like a modern site. So if you care about that sort of thing, then maybe you would want to use Grav, for instance. Now if you don't, then who knows? Maybe you really just want to use FlatPress. I don't know. Like I said, I haven't looked into FlatPress enough lately to feel comfortable about how well maintained it is. But Grav is well maintained, it is being maintained, and I've talked to the developers, not at length, but I've had conversations with the developers, and it's a healthy little project. It's open source, you can find all of the source code on GitHub, and you can contribute, maybe, and it's worth checking out, in other words, if you're looking to build a site. And I think the hidden gem here is it's automated RSS and Atom feed thing. If I'd known about that, who knows? I might have built GNU World Order. I mean, at the time, I don't think it did exist, the automated feed thing. But if I'd known about that, I might have built GNU World Order around Grav, really, because it just makes it so easy. You know, it's just so nice to have automated RSS and Atom feeds. I mean, that's a real feature. Like honestly, that's a serious, serious feature. So that's really neat that Grav exists, that it makes blogging a flat file affair, and that it makes the feed generation dead simple, something you don't even have to think about. Now let's talk about the problems with Grav, because as I have used Grav very, very heavily in the past month, really, it's just been a month, but it has been in some cases 8-hour days working to adjust something. And so let's talk a little bit about that. So the first thing to note is that when they say flat file graph, CMS, they do technically mean flat file, but it's not quite as flat as flat used to be. In other words, when people log into your site, or go to your site rather, and look at a web page, a blog post, they're not actually seeing example.com/blog/mypost/index.html or .whatever, PHP or whatever. They're not seeing that file, right? Graph is parsing what you post to it, whether it's a blog.md or an item.md. It is parsing that. It is converting it to HTML through a series of filters and displaying the resulting cached page to them, or even maybe not cached, but assembled is the key term here. It's an assembled page. It is something that it is throwing together more or less dynamically on the server to display to a person. The difference is between the difference between Graph and, for instance, WordPress is that there's no database involved, and that's what makes Graph a flat file CMS. But in terms of wanting to be able to point to the exact file on the server and relate it to what you are seeing in your web browser window, that's a bit harder, and that's not going to exactly happen. Does that happen on any flat file CMS? Honestly, I don't know. I never really had to think about it that hard back when I was using FlatPress. I never really thought about it back when I was using Graph the first time around back in, 4 years ago, whatever. But it's just something to keep in mind that if you're thinking flat file CMS means there's going to be a file for every page, that's not necessarily true. It's close to being true. It's not necessarily completely true. One of the reasons I turned to Graph as well was, as I said, WordPress has a lot of stuff to learn about, like, kind of the layout of the system and where is everything kept and child themes and all that stuff. Turns out Graph is the same way. If you really want to get into Graph and structure a site, really anything other than the default. Like, I mean, what I'm saying is that if you want to use Graph, you can pull a bunch of plugins down off of the Graph site, install them pretty easily into Graph. They make it really easy to install. You can either download it manually and put it into the right place, or you can even just run a GPM command from within the Graph folder. It's a PHP script, I think, that basically pulls stuff down, probably using, Pear or some PHP package management. I don't know. But whatever it's doing is it downloads the thing, it places it in the right place, and then your plugin is installed. So if you do that, and you're happy with exactly what they are giving you, then you don't ever have to learn about Graph. But if you want anything different, I'm talking anything, like you want any little tiny change to be made, then you're going to have to learn to a varying degree about Graph and how it's laid out. And that might be something as simple as, well, you need to add this one little attribute to a config file for this plugin, okay? Where is that? Well, it's somewhere in the user folder, because it's very good about keeping any changes that you make within your user folder. But where in the user folder? And which config file? And why are there so many config files per plugin? And why are some called plugin.config and the others are called like plugin.yaml, and like which one do I edit? You have to learn that stuff. It's not that hard, but you do have to learn it, and you have to do some reading up on it, and sometimes you have to do reading up per plugin because it's not all covered in the main Graph docs. I think the most egregious error, however, is some of the fragiler parts of Graph. Now, Graph is great because, as I've said, you don't have a database. There's not a whole lot of programmatic things happening within Graph. There are things. It's not, like if you're thinking, oh, this is going to be a great website because it's going to make my flat HTML files look really pretty. That's not what Graph is. It is a very dynamic website. So there are scripts running and things are happening on the Graph website or in the Graph framework. It's a lot simpler though than something like WordPress or Drupal, or presumably Joomla. I've never used Joomla, and so it's a little bit you don't have to worry quite as much about security updates and things like that, because there's just not quite as much going on. But that having been said, there are times where grav falls over and falls really, really hard. It has happened weekly to me. Saying it has happened weekly is charitable. It has happened multiple times a week, and in a very, very dramatic way. So here's this grav website. It looks fantastic. It looks pretty. It looks modern. It's easy to post to it because it's so flexible. It's great. One wrong path for an image file, the whole website falls over. Now that sounds really bad, right? It is really bad. Now, it's not as bad as I'm making it out to sound. So if I have an image file in the text of my blog post and it's the incorrect path, then it fails gracefully like HTML normally does. You see no image. Maybe you see the alt text there instead. Maybe you see a broken image, an image representing a broken image. I don't remember, but certainly the whole site doesn't fall over. But there is an issue with these YAML headers that provide the metadata for a blog post, where if there is, as far as I can tell, practically any error in the YAML at the head of a text file makes your entire site fail. No, I must be wrong. I have to be wrong on that, right? It's just that one post. It's not the whole site. That would be madness for the entire site to fail because of one wrong YAML setting in a subdirectory. No, that doesn't make sense. No, I'm telling you, dear listener, the entire site as of 1.5.6 fails if you have incorrect YAML data in any file of your blog pages. It doesn't matter how small the error is to you. If you forgot to close a quote around a subtitle or a title, if you issued an incorrect date that it just couldn't parse, if you have an image name that it cannot find, then the entire site now does not work. Now, this is obviously a serious problem, first of all, and it is one that I have filed a bug against. Sadly, so far, they do seem to be fine with their choice here. They actually don't appear to agree with me that the entire site should not fail because of incorrect YAML data in a text file. I can see the page failing. That seems reasonable to me, but the entire site falling over because of that seems unreasonable to me. I've made a case for it in the bug report, and they just don't seem to agree. I've also made a case for the fact that when it fails, it shouldn't display all kinds of user-centric information there on the page for everyone to see, which is what it does. So instead of loading your site, it just tells you the exact path of your install. So now anyone looking at your website has immediately gained your web account username or the username of who you are on the server. It's learned a lot about your file structure on that server. That seems really bad to me, and I have tried to impress that upon the Grav developer who is answering the bug report, and they just don't appear to agree with me. They say that YAML is important, that you have to have an error when YAML fails, or else it would just fail silently and you wouldn't know what was going on. And that's the only way to deliver that error message. And that error message is fine. Even as I'm saying it aloud, I am literally doubting myself. I feel like I must have something wrong. And I have this sudden desire to go and test it. And make sure that I'm not crazy. But this has been a month of testing and ongoing. Sort of like, how can we make this not happen? And I haven't been able to make it happen. Now, I've made one thing not fail. So there was another problem with the blog whereby I think it was what they call the hero image. If the hero image is what was incorrect in the YAML, like if you couldn't find that file, it would again just crash the entire site. So I got it to the point, I went in and edited some template files, and I have it now to the point where if the hero image is incorrect in the YAML of your post, then it simply doesn't render an image in the blog list, in the list of posts. And and that's not even really all me. That fallback is in place in one of the plugins that or one of the libraries that they themselves are using to generate thumbnails. So that's sort of based around the theme. So I've submitted that. I've submitted a pull request as you do on GitHub. You don't send a patch and ask for a merge. You have to do this fancy log into GitHub and issue this fancy pull request thing, and you have to fork the repo and all this convoluted workflow that makes Git a lot more complex than it needs to be. So I did that, did the pull request. So far, they have not, as of this recording, they have not merged that into their code yet. Hopefully they will, because it's a big fix. It would at least prevent a missing hero image from blowing up your entire site. But any other YAML error still blows up your entire site. So it's huge, huge, huge. I mean, it's horrible, like just outrageously bad, to the point that I almost questioned whether I should even talk about Grav on the show, because I felt like maybe this isn't something that I'm recommending. But in another bug report on another unrelated issue, maybe it was semi-related, they told me, well, there's this admin plugin which provides a GUI. Now, you'll recall just earlier in this episode, I was saying I really like the flexibility of this and that because I don't have to use the GUI. So the admin plugin provides a GUI. So if you go into your, if you're a user of Grav, you can log into this admin interface and make blog posts the way you do, for instance, with WordPress. Now, I actually have no interest in this whatsoever. And apparently their answer, their official answer, again, as of this recording, is that if you don't like how Grav blows up if you make an error in the YAML at the head of your blog post, then don't edit your blog posts in plain text files and do it through the admin interface, because that provides, I guess, fields and probably drop-down menus and things like that to make sure that when you're entering the YAML stuff, that it's valid data and you don't make stupid mistakes like, oh, I forgot to, I opened a quote here on my subtitle or my title and forgot to close it, or whatever it might be. So that's something to be aware of. Another problem that I've experienced is Grav has abused some rather common conventions, not even conventions, really standards. So for instance, Grav expects to get markdown files from you. That's the format of Grav content is markdown. So you put a markdown file of a certain name in a certain place, and it parses it, turns it into HTML, presents it to the users, to your visitors. Markdown has a definition insofar as markdown has any definition, right? I mean, that's one of the classic problems with markdown, is that there's no spec for markdown. And you might say, oh, but that one site with where it started, that's not a spec. As many people have observed, that's a rough guideline for how markdown might appear, and it doesn't provide a whole lot. And it also is fuzzy on other things and so on. So people have taken that idea and they've sort of run with it. So you've got different quote unquote flavors of markdown. So you've got GitHub markdown, you've got markdown, you've got something else markdown. Someone is trying to establish a firm standard called Common Mark, and that's great, but it seems to be a little bit of a niche and not everyone's jumped on board with that yet. Either way, even in the original markdown spec, it is defined that when you create an Ahref element in HTML, or a link, a hot link in HTML, or rather in markdown for destination to mark to HTML, you put in square brackets some term, and then in parentheses the URL to which you want to link, and the result is that the string in the square brackets becomes the text of the href of the ahref, the a element that you in your HTML. So for instance, if I put square bracket foo close square bracket parentheses http://example.com close parentheses, then in HTML it becomes bracket a space href equals quote http://example.com close quote close bracket foo and then close the a tag. And that's something that's defined in Markdown. So people are expecting that when they type that, then the HTML is going to be generated in that same way. For whatever reason, Graph decided that they were going to use the contents in the square brackets. Could be a little bit fuzzy on this because I haven't looked it up lately. But it's generally if you use you can use the contents of the square brackets to define a custom class for that link, I think it is. And then when you do that, you can also add to your link question mark and then some string. So you're hearing me correctly here. You're adding content to your URL that will manipulate the manner in which Grav interprets or renders the, or parses, I guess, the link. So that's obviously not what you would expect, right? If you knew Markdown and you were told you can write Markdown in this text file and Graph will parse it and turn it into HTML, then you would expect that if you were to type, say, a link with a question mark in it, that that would be turned into an HTML link with a question mark in it. But it turns out that no, Graph clobbers that and uses its own question mark syntax to do funky Grav only things like adding classes or IDs to that element. Now that seems like a really, really bad idea, and it probably would have been a better idea to define their own markup, you know, their own like Grav markdown, and rather than change existing markdown to add some kind of syntax, like maybe another set of square brackets after any URL becomes additional classes and ID elements that you could apply to that ahref element that gets when it is rendered out to HTML, something like that. But yeah, it is true that if you have text in the square brackets of a link, then any question mark in the link becomes parsed by Grav. It gets parsed not as a URL but as metadata. That's a pain point. And again, I've raised this issue as a bug. They have declared that is the way that Grav works. So some problems. There are some problems with the way sort of Grav works, at least in my humble opinion. And it's an opinion that is simply different than the Grav developers. So if they don't agree with the way that I see it, then obviously they're not going to change it. And from what I can tell so far, they don't agree. Now, I've still got a pull request outstanding, so we'll see what happens there. The other ones are, you know, it's really just the way that I think things should or should not be done versus the way they clearly think things should or should not be done. The link munging problem, the developer who was responding to the bug report has pointed out that if they were to change it now, then that would break existing Grav installs. So it's kind of one of those things that they don't have a whole lot of an alternative at this point. They just kind of have to live with it, which I think, I mean, again, I'm telling people that, hey, this is the Markdown that we use. It needs to be clearer that when they say, hey, your blog posts are written in Markdown, they should be clear that they're not talking about Markdown, the actual, what people have learned. It's a new Markdown. And I really wish someone would trademark Markdown, or Common Mark should just get off the ground so that people don't use that term so generically, because you can say, oh, it's Markdown, and people think it's Markdown, but it's not really Markdown. It's Grav Markdown, or GitHub Markdown, or what have you. Now, as you may or may not know about Markdown, you can ignore Markdown entirely and just write in HTML. And it turns out that you can do that for Graph as well. So it's a workaround. The problem with this workaround is that then if you forget to close a tag, for instance, in your HTML or something, any mistake in HTML basically stops the parsing. It stops Graph from parsing the HTML. It does this silently, so it does not break your page or your site, but it also doesn't log an error that I can find. So you believe everything is fine until you go to the website and read the post and realize it stops halfway through because there was a para tag that never got closed, or an A tag that didn't get, a quote that didn't get, something's wrong in the HTML. So it becomes a very kind of strict HTML thing that you now, I guess, in order to check that, you would have to sort of verify. So I've gone on for a long time about the problems, and in spite of all that, I have to say that Graph is a really slick little system. There are other systems to use and to look at. A lot of people have told me about Hugo. Hugo is a framework for building web pages, and it appears to be pretty robust and pretty nice. There's a lot of beautiful themes out there for it. And there are a few others. There are a couple of frameworks like this that get thrown around and promoted. And I can't say, which is the best one, because like I say, I've only spent this much time with Graph. And in spite of my complaints that I've just talked about, those were the complaints. And I feel like a lot of times those pain points are going to be encountered by you only if you have a certain workflow. And if you work differently than I do, then you may never see those ever. That might not be a problem for you. I wanted to address them because I didn't want there to be just an unqualified recommendation of Graph. But I am recommending Graph. I think it's a really cool little system. It's a lot of fun to work with. And the digging into the internals that I have had to do has actually been really nice. It's got a good little system back there going, and it's pretty easy to customize things. I feel like it's easier to customize Graph, for instance, than WordPress. Is it easier than Hugo or the others? I don't know. Who knows? But yeah, I've been pretty happy with Graph all in all. And the development team for Graph, while they don't always agree with everything that I say, has been very responsive traditionally. I mean, they haven't pulled in my merge to make the site not fall over under certain conditions, but that's fine. Maybe they'll get around to it. Who knows? But I mean, it's an active project. I mean, I'm sure others are active as well. But I mean, they've been responsive, and they've always been responsive. Even back when I was first using Graph, they were really responsive, and that's pretty cool. So I don't know. I am recommending Graph, and while I'm at it, I'm going to recommend another website. It's not a framework website. It is something built on Graph. So if you go to mixedsignals.ml, that is the word mixed, M-I-X-E-D. And then signals, signals.ml, as in Mike Lima, then you will find a gaming-related website. Now, this gaming-related website, mixedsignals.ml, is built on Graph, and it is populated, the contents of it, is populated by myself and Lost in Bronx and one Seth Kinlan. So the content tends to be game-oriented. Game meaning generally RPG, although I do intend to probably put other stuff on there, maybe some card games, some board game, that type of content. But there's an emphasis on role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons and so on. Now, if you're into Dungeons and Dragons, then this site may be of interest to you, actually. It's full of good ideas. That's kind of what it excels at, is just throwing a bunch of ideas online in a structured way. And we'll get more and more structured as we go along. Eventually, we will collect some number of blog posts and put them into an easily sort of organized and downloaded book for people to download and or purchase. But in the meantime, we're throwing ideas online. I'm throwing some reviews online of some tech books that I've read. And we're just putting everything up there, because why not? People have been asking me, hey, where's all that content from this old site or that old site? Well, it's all going to end up here, mixedsignals.ml. That's the hub for everything that I put online, kind of from this point on. Slacker Media and GNU World Order will remain their own independent sites because those are handy places for them to be, and they're not directly related to mixed signals, I guess. But the idea is that all that extra stuff that I used to sprinkle around in a gopher site here or a hidden website there, it's all going to be on mixed signals eventually. The organization of it is kind of chaotic, and that's kind of on purpose. We kind of are, we're throwing everything into the central blog feed, and we're using tags to enable people to kind of filter out what they may be interested in at any given moment. And I think that that's going to kind of work out pretty well. So the tech tag, for instance, will bring up any kind of really technical content, like actual, there's, I don't think there is any tech content on there right now, but like serious tech content, like here's how to set up an Apache server or something like that, or here's a tip for Python. That'll be under the tech tag. And so if you go there and you're not interested in the gaming stuff and you just want the tech, then you'll be able to click on the tech tag and get just the blog posts with the technology stuff. If you're there just because you're looking for a cool new cursed item because you're playing in a game and your players have just uncovered a treasure chest and you have to come up with an idea for what they just found because it's not written in the book that you bought, then you can go to the tag that says curse and click on that, and sure enough, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 as of this recording, 7 cursed items, any one of which you could just throw into a treasure chest along with some generic gold pieces, and your players will be very happy, and then they will be very sad. And that's kind of the point of a game, really, is to challenge, to overcome challenges. So that's kind of the idea of this site. Now, a lot of people have first asked me, hey, where's all that content from, this place or that place? Okay, so the answer is here, mixedsignals.ml. Other people have asked me in the past, how can I support the show, the podcast, the New World Order? The answer is here, mixedsignals.ml. If you want to support what I'm doing online, GNU World Order, Slacker Media, whatever, just go to mixedsignals.ml and subscribe to our feed and interact with the site in some way. I'm trying to kind of build up this thing as a hub for people to go to and access content. And not all of it will appeal to everyone, but I'm hoping that it'll appeal, a little bit of it will appeal to many people, to both my friends in the tech world and the gaming world and the places where those intersect and so on. So if you've asked me in the past, can I send you money to help with this, or can I send you something, or can I do this or that? No, you can't. I don't need any of those things. But what I would like for you to do is go to mixedsignals.ml and subscribe to the RSS or the Atom feed, Atom being the superior format. But not quite as widely as widely recognized. So either one of those is fine. You can do that. And of course, as always, well, as always, ever since a couple of weeks ago, you can also purchase a book called Developing Games on the Raspberry Pi from A Press Publishing, I think. You can go to apress.com. Developing Games on the Raspberry Pi. It's a great book. I'm highly recommending it. It's about Lua. It is really, really fun to use. It is enlightening. It has tips that you will literally find nowhere else on the internet. I know this because there is nothing online right now about that little tiny OpenAL bug that you'll encounter on the Raspberry Pi 3 when trying to use it. Trust me. So those are the ways that you can support the show. Honest, that's all I need. Is you to subscribe to mixedsignals.ml and interact with the website as you see fit. And if you want, go purchase the book about the Raspberry Pi and Lua. And if you have no interest in supporting the show, that's fine too. I've never actually asked for support, so it's fine if you're thinking, well, I don't really need to support you quite too. I'm just here to hear some interesting technical talk for an hour. And that is actually all I really expect from anyone. So thanks for listening to the show. I appreciate it. Now go hunt down some good Greek or Turkish or Russian coffee, and I'll talk to you next time. World Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augencast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Wait a minute, we got something to settle first. Remember, I've been fooled before. I'm talking about the clever little deal you've made.